So one of them, you know, going back to ocean acidification, these are like the fragile, you know, microbes. Well, they're actually snails, relatives of snails, but they're part of the microbiome. Acidification is going to be a problem as more CO2 is absorbed into the ocean and the sea becomes more acidic. Part of the solution to this problem is actually tied into some of the solutions to seafood security, which I think it's a really nice kind of connection of different solutions. So, the global human population has gotten really, really large. I think it's estimated to hit something around 10 billion by the end of the century. And, you know, we're running out of space. There are droughts. There are shortages on some of the elements that are used in fertilizers. And a lot of those problems don't exist in the ocean, right? You're never going to run out of water in the ocean. I should not say never, because people once said we're never going to run out of cod, and they were wrong. But, you know, there's plenty of water in the ocean. There's a lot of it. There's a lot of nutrients that exist naturally in the ocean. And in parts of the world where there already are billions of people, like China and even India, they've figured out that if you grow kelp, you can produce food much more efficiently. This is just an aerial image. I think this is in Taiwan, actually, of just like the scale of kelp farms. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. One of the bonuses of growing kelp is that they're photosynthesizers. They take up CO2. So they actually remove carbon from the water and can counteract that acidification process. It's not, you can't really, you know, we don't know of a way to do this on a global scale enough to actually counteract the CO2 effect globally. But if you think locally, you know, in the coastal zone, where acidification really could matter to shellfish, you know. So, things are changing really fast. I think I'm going to put this, I lied about that being the last graph, I guess. But I'm going to turn all these graphs into like a cartoon version of the way I see this. This is a climate change plot. It's the sort of thing that people put in reports or sometimes news stories to describe climate change. This is just global temperature going up through the year 2000, and then you see these different scenarios. That's what people do. They say, oh, you know, if we curb our greenhouse gas emissions, you know, things could level off. There's the business as usual where things keep going up. There's so different scenarios of temperature. And I think what this puts in people's mind, or at least in my mind, is a picture that looks something like this. Here we are now. Here's the year 2100. And on the vertical axis is something we worry about. It could be global warming. It could be temperature. It could be sea level. It could be ocean acidification. It could be jellyfish. It could be all kinds of things. But we're looking at this, you know, we look at this graph. We see a smooth line that does something like that. And we're worried about this point out here in 2100 where all this bad stuff is going to happen. The way I think we should be looking at it is more like this, because this is what really happens. We don't go up this smooth trajectory to like a warmer world or whatever. There's a lot of ups and downs along that incline. And the Gulf of Maine, in terms of temperature, is going through one of those rapid ups right now. There's going to be times where it levels off and goes back down, and then times when it goes up rapidly again. But it's really those sharp increases that you know, can take an ecosystem and really turn it inside out. And it's the same thing, you know, if you think about storm surges, right? It's not this gradual sea level rise that's going to get us. It's when the next big hurricane comes through, or the next big, you know, the flooding in Louisiana, that sort of thing. It's these events, you know, the sea level is still on average rising gradually like that, but there are these big events that really affect us a lot more than others. And the Gulf of Maine just happens to be the first sort of example of a system going through something like this. And so there's a lot, I think, that we can learn from it, both to sort of help ourselves, but also lessons that we can export to other places. You know, if you're thinking about, you know, if you're worried about what this place is going to look like for your kids or your grandkids, you know, maybe you should look at the Gulf of Maine and think about what's happening now and what could happen down the road for you. So here's my next pause before I go into tools for adaptation. Because to me, it's not all gloom and doom, actually. There are two sides to the climate change story, to the response to climate change.
Right.
One of them is mitigation. That's really important. That's just like the big agreements that they've just come to in Paris is really key to reducing the problem at its source. But to some degree, we're already locked into some of this change. Even if we, you know, shut everything down right now, there's still going to be residual warming that comes and residual sea level rise. And so the other part of that equation is adaptation, which is what I really like to think about. I think I have to think about this optimistically in some ways because I have kids and this stuff, these things are happening now and they're affecting all of us. But it's also, you know, it's exciting from a scientific point of view. And you can take this, some of this basic research, whether it's on the ocean microbiome, which I'm going to talk about in a minute, or to do with other technologies and really help, help our society to adapt to some of these changes. So maybe before I go into an adaptation, I could pause again. Catch my breath, then, if you have some questions. Yeah.
That change in 2012 when the lawsuit came in early, is that coming?
It's actually really tied to April bottom temperatures. So that there's something about, so the scientists, I know a couple that are working closely on this problem. They're still trying to figure out the exact mechanism behind kind of the cue that happens there, but what they've figured out is, you know, if you go back over the last 20 or 30 years that we have data, if you look at the April, mid-April bottom temperatures, it's almost an exact correlation to when the lobsters arrive on shore in, well, it ranges anywhere from June to, through July, depending on how warm it is. Excuse me. So the answer to your question is it just depends how warm it was in April. So in years where the April temperatures have been cooled, we have had a couple of those since 2012, indeed the lobsters showed up more at their normal time. And in other years, like I think this was a warm year in April, and I think they came in a little bit early this year, and last year as well, they were a little bit early. Nothing quite as early as 2012, but it seems to be really key to that that April temperature signal.
So,
just
to follow
up,
the 4 degrees or 30 degrees warming in the last 10 years? That's a surface, that was a surface temperature.
Yeah, so that was what I was showing with surface temperature. The heat wave that came through in 2012 was surface to bottom. It was about 3 degrees C warmer than average temperatures pretty much for the whole year. You know, normally when you see these changes, it'll be like a warm summer, a warm winter, and this heat wave, they're calling it, lasted for about 18 months. And it was surface to bottom.
Looking at those several graphs where you had the gradual rise and then you had the spike for 2012,
What
if that were continuing? Is anybody worried that that line is going to keep on going instead of the gradual line that you predicted?
Yeah, that's a good question. So what the model is saying over the kind of the long term out to 2100 is that we are going to be warming faster than the rest of the ocean. For that really steep line to continue, you know, we would really go off the charts. I don't think it's sort of physically, I shouldn't say it's physically possible, but it's probably going to level off at some point. There were other reasons for the rapid rise in temperature. Part of it is, this is actually one of the things I cut out of my talk to reduce the time, but there are these climate oscillations in the ocean. The one that you've heard about the most is El Nino. That happens on these kind of decadal scales of warming and cooling. There are other examples throughout the ocean. There are a couple in the Atlantic. There's another one in the Pacific. And they all really affect, they can all affect Gulf of Maine temperatures, or temperatures anywhere, but in this case, the Gulf of Maine. They're not in phase with each other. So one could be high and another could be low, and they can balance out. And the Gulf of Maine might just be average in that case. And over the last 10 years, a bunch of them have kind of also come into phase to add additional warming to the Gulf of Maine. So because they have a rough cyclicity to them, we expect those to go out of phase. And so that steepness of that line will probably reduce to some degree. But some of the other effects, like the background warming and the slowdown of the kind of the ocean circulation, probably will continue to have an effect. And so we do still expect a more rapid warming in other parts of the ocean. Yeah?
So the Gulf of Maine and the whole sort of northeast corridor there, is the hottest, has gotten hotter than any other part of the ocean in the last 10 years?
The rate of change is the fastest.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
The water itself is
right.
not hotter
right.
than
right.
the
okay.
drop.
The rate of change.
But the rate of change.
So, yes. And that is, so you just answered some of my question,
yeah.
what you just said, but is there some way in which it's just geography is why it's there? It's,
yeah. Yeah, basically.
That's really the reason why that the concentration of the increase, the rapid increase.
Yeah, I mean, partly it's because there's the Gulf Stream, the warm current, and then there's the Labrador Current coming from the Arctic, and we just happen to be right around where they meet. Part of it, too, is that we're this kind of shallow, semi-enclosed sea with this deep channel that allows that warm water to come in. I'm not sure how well you can see that from the, yeah, from the animation. So the blacked out area is water shallower than, I don't know, let's say 50 meters. I don't know exactly what it is, but, and then the water in the middle is much deeper. So it's almost, we are still almost enclosed in a lot of ways, and then there's that one deep channel that allows some of that Atlantic water to come in.
So it's not,
so, yeah,
the Northeast has a lot of issues because of, wind coming here, and air quality,
yeah,
et cetera,
yeah.
But it's not because of
nope,
not human per se.
Other than the general
right.
way of warming
right.
is changing the circulation patterns, yeah. Yep, it's kind of location and our geometry. Oh, yeah.
So when you look at the world the last 15 months,
yeah.
the older years have been out of some record. So
yeah.
how did that... How do you make models?
yeah.
When that's never happened before.
Well, in the ocean, so water has about 100 times the heat capacity of air, which basically means, to heat the same volume of water takes about 100 times as much energy as heating the same volume of air. So when you have a really warm year in the atmosphere, it takes a while for that information to sort of propagate into the ocean. You know, when you look at the atmospheric temperature is doing this, and the ocean will kind of make this nice smooth line. So that heat does get absorbed into the ocean, but it doesn't change the ocean temperature as rapidly. It's sort of integrated over a much longer period of time. I don't know if that exactly answers what you're asking.
It feels like false comfort.
what does?
The ocean is not going to change as quickly as the air because it takes so much more energy to warm
yeah.
it.
Yeah, actually, the ocean is one of the main reasons why we have a stable climate. You know, it's if we didn't have the ocean, then greenhouse gases would make the Earth warm much, much faster. So in a way, we should be thankful, I guess, that it's there. But you're right. I mean,
but then the ice is melting faster,
yeah.
so you don't have that reflection.
That's right. There are other ways that heat works its way into the system. And there are a bunch of feedbacks. And so one of them, like you say, is ice. So we lose the fact that they reflect heat back off of the Earth as they melt. There are there's permafrost, which is melting, and that's actually releasing more greenhouse gases like methane, which is a powerful greenhouse gas. There are a whole bunch of feedbacks that once you start the system warming actually make it worse. There are a few negative feedbacks as well, but most of the feedbacks we know about are positive feedbacks that sort of make it worse.
So it seems like when this rapid change and then human life and animal life, plant life can't adapt as quickly as the change is,
yep.
then adaptation is kind of too slow in response.
Yeah, so when I say adaptation, I don't mean it in an evolutionary sense. I mean, what can we do to start dealing with this for ourselves? Yeah, what are the tools we can use to help deal with that part of change that we're sort of locked into? Yeah.
Yes, one of the adaptations for us to be kind of familiar with fish that are we presume are more southerly, but now will become standard fishes, groupers, and other warm water species will be moving into here?
Yeah, so for example, right now, 90-something percent of our fishery is one species. And that species, you know, there aren't really fisheries in southern New England anymore because of the water temperature. And at some point, it will be too warm, probably it will be too warm in the Gulf of Maine for lobsters. Mm-hmm. Right? So diversifying and thinking about ways to exploit some of the species that are coming in would be a way for a tool for adaptation for the fisheries. And there are there's a whole slew of regulatory issues around that that I only have a very kind of loose grasp of. But for example, some of the species that come in, the rights to fish them belong to fishermen in like New Jersey, for example, because that's where the fish have historically been. So they might come in and be an abundant resource that people here can't fish. That wasn't the case for longfin squid, but it can be the case for others. So, you know, part of the tool for adaptation is just for management, for example, to start thinking about things in a changing way rather than, you know, it's almost the same way conservationists often think of going back to this pristine state. How can we restore this stock to what it used to be when it could be that it's too warm now for that species to even be in the Gulf of Maine? So I think some of these ideas are percolating throughout different communities, fishing communities, management communities, and scientific communities, and figuring out how to use that knowledge to allow us to adapt is a real challenge. I mean, it's science is involved, but also the human dimension makes it really complex. But yeah, that's a great example. And, you know, there are lots and lots of examples of tools for adaptation. I'm going to show you a few here that relate to the ocean microbiome because that kind of brings it back to the theme of the artwork that's out there. But there are lots and lots of other ones, too, that I'm not mentioning. And I'd be happy to stick around and, you know, tell you what I know about those as well. So one of them, you know, going back to ocean acidification, these are like the fragile, you know, microbes. Well, they're actually snails, the relatives of snails, but they're part of the microbiome. Acidification is going to be a problem as more CO2 is absorbed into the ocean and the sea becomes more acidic. Part of the solution to this problem is actually tied into some of the solutions to seafood security, which I think it's a really nice kind of connection of different solutions. So, the global human population has gotten really, really large. I think it's estimated to hit something around 10 billion by the end of the century. And, you know, we're running out of space. There are droughts. There are shortages on some of the elements that are used in fertilizers. And a lot of those problems don't exist in the ocean. Right, you're never going to run out of water in the ocean. I should not say never because people once said we're never going to run out of cod and they were wrong. But, you know, there's plenty of water in the ocean. There's a lot of it. There's a lot of nutrients that exist naturally in the ocean. And in parts of the world where there already are billions of people like China and India, they've figured out that if you grow kelp, you can produce food much more efficiently. This is just an aerial image. I think this is in Taiwan, actually, of just like the scale of kelp farms. Yeah, it's pretty amazing. One of the bonuses of growing kelp is that they're photosynthesizers. They take up CO2. So they actually remove carbon from the water and can counteract that acidification process. It's not, you can't really... You know, we don't know of a way to do this on a global scale enough to actually counteract the CO2 effect globally. But if you think locally, you know, in the coastal zone, where acidification really could matter to shellfish, you know, shellfish that are growing and harvested naturally or shellfish that are grown by people for consumption, where acidification could really become a problem, we're investigating ways that you might couple that with kelp growth so that you can draw down some of that CO2. You know, keep the sort of, I think of it as the ocean microbiome in a sort of healthier state, a healthier ecosystem, and sort of counteract that acidification effect.